Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Small Animal Surgery, Richard Meeson. Thank you, Richard. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this lunchtime webinar on pancarpal arthrodesis. So the plan is we're going to look at the reasons why you would perform a pancarpal arthrodesis, and then we're going to talk about the principles of arthrodesis so that we can get a good outcome. Then we'll do some preoperative planning and actually work our way through the surgical procedure itself. And then we'll discuss the postoperative management, and then we will look at the reasons why we do certain things and what the evidence base is for them. So the most common reasons that we see carpal hyperextension, that we do pancarpal arthrodesis for, is carpal hyperextension injuries, which are quite commonly a result of dogs leaping out of first floor windows, so high level jumps. But we also see it as a degenerative process, as shown in this video, in collie breeds. And you can see that this dog is walking along and there's complete collapse of the antebrachial carpal joint, and this dog actually also has this problem in his hind legs as well, and you can see this banana shaped calcaneal caudal instability, so not a good place to be. We also may do pancarpal arthrodesis for instabilities in the carpus, such as varus or valgal instabilities, as shown here in this little dog, you see where the pointer is, or for complete joint subluxations. Another reason to perform pancarpal arthrodesis would be severe osteoarthritis, and occasionally we see dogs with rheumatoid arthritis as well. This can also be a useful salvage procedure if you've got juxtaarticular fractures or articular fractures that are non-repairable, and occasionally it forms part of a limb salvage procedure where you have a distal radial osteosarcoma. And I think the important thing to remember about pancarpal arthrodesis is it is a salvage surgery, so we don't need to rush into these procedures. We can plan and make sure we're doing the right thing. So what is an arthrodesis? So it actually comes from the Greek word for joint, which is arthr, and desis, which is dyne, so you get arthrodesis. And it really means a surgical fusion of a joint to form a bony union. And as I said, it's a salvage procedure, and it results in pain-free function, which we couldn't achieve by any other means. It is slightly different from ankylosis, which is actually when the body forms an immobilization that you don't actually want. That's a pathological condition rather than a surgically induced one. So what are the key principles of arthrodesis? And this applies to pancarpal, pantarsal, elbow, shoulder. So our first principle is we must remove all the articular cartilage. This is the biggest cause of failure of arthrodesis, leaving some cartilage behind. And a curette can be used, but also a high-speed burr is very effective. So this is a really good way of achieving a removal of all the articular cartilage. But you say if you don't have one, you can use a curette. And it's also important to open up channels through the subchondral bone plate, because if there's been a diseased joint, then that plate could be quite thick. So we actually will drill holes up to open it out and allow the stem cells through. The second key principle is rigid internal fixation. Now, most commonly we would do this with plate and screws, but occasionally, and there are reports of using external skeletal fixators, such as this dog. Now, this dog had fractures and infection, and this is the reason why I arthrodesis with a external skeletal fixator. It's not the preferred means, but it is possible. And this dog did go on to have a complete fusion across the tarsus, but let's say it wouldn't be my first choice. The next principle is to achieve compression. Now, the best way to do this is to use a dynamic compression style plate. You see it's got these oval holes, and the screw is placed eccentrically in the hole such that when you tighten the screw down, it slides and compresses the fracture gap together. And what you can see here is how this causes a lot of pressure and tight contact at the gap, which actually improves fracture healing. The fourth principle is to have some sort of biological stimulus. This is most commonly a cancellous bone autograft, and we normally get this from metaphyseal bone because that's where you've got lots of cancellous bone. And most commonly, this will be done in the proximal humerus, but you could go for the distal femur, the proximal femur, or the tibia, or even from the ilial wing, which is what's actually most commonly done in people. Arthrodeses are quite prone to problems with soft tissues, so it's very important to preserve the soft tissues and be very careful about the vascularization. And then they need careful planning, so you need to make sure you've got the right implant, and you need to consider what angle should the joints be fused at, and they do vary by joint. And there's always a bit of a compromise between the function, whether the dog's sitting, standing, or running, so you have to consider that. Generally speaking, these are the textbook angles that we tend to use. So the biological stimulus can be achieved in several ways, and healing of bone can be boosted by osteogenesis, which is when we deliver cancellous bone graft, and actually that contains some stem cells, or we could give stem cells directly. And about 10% of the cells survive. The next option is what's called osteoconduction. This is actually provides a 3D scaffold that supports the formation of new bone, but doesn't actually provide any stem cells or growth factors. The third means to stimulate fracture healing or arthrodesis is osteoinduction. So this is actually growth factors stimulating local stem cells to differentiate, and they also recruit local cells to drive new bone formation. And this is quite commonly done with a product called demineralized bone matrix. And you can also provide mechanical support. This tends to be only cortical bone struts because they actually have a mechanical strength. So, biological stimulus could be provided by an autograft. So, this is quite good because it's non-immunogenic, because it's from the animal that's receiving it. It will not, should not transmit a new disease, and it's always available because the animal's always got somewhere to take some cancellous bone graft from. But there is a risk of donor site morbidity, which could lead to pain, swelling, and very occasionally you may get a fracture. Sometimes you only get limited amounts. It's particularly a problem in cats when you tend to get very small amounts of bone graft. And it does take time to take a cancellous bone graft. So sometimes it's helpful to have another surgeon or another vet scrubbed in to take this while you're doing the rest of the procedure. The most common types are cancellous bone graft, but you can also get cortical cancellous struts, where if you took top of the wing of the ilium off, you could potentially use stem cells. They're either minimally manipulated or cultured. And this is an example of cancellous bone graft that's been taken out of the proximal humerus. Allografts are taken from an animal of the same species, but it's not the same, not from their own host. The pros about them is that they're very readily available off the shelf. You don't have a donor site morbidity issue. They can speed up surgical times, and generally you get quite a lot of them. So this is a veterinary tissue bank, demineralized bone matrix you see here. You hydrate it and you get quite a large volume of product. But they are quite costly. Occasionally you get supply issues. Currently it's not difficult to get cat demineralized bone matrix. And you do have to be careful with the type of allograft that you choose. And currently there's no conclusive evidence as to which one is the best to use. Generally, I would say demineralized bone matrix is the best bet because it has that osteoinductive potential. And I would veer away from cancellous bone chips, which are only osteoconductive, so only producing a scaffold to support new bone formation. You can get different types of allogenic graft material. They may be and generally they're freeze-dried and they're irradiated to make them safe. And you're going to get struts or blocks or powders. There are also synthetic materials. These have been quite popular in the use in humans. This is a human tibia where they've been used to infill a gap, used to stimulate bone formation in the vertebral strengthening, and here in the jaw. So they're designed to emulate normal bone. So they've kind of got a, here's an example of one of these materials, and they've got sort of a porous structure that looks quite similar to bone. So they provide a scaffold. You get different types, such as hydroxyapatite, or bioglass or calcium carbonate or tricalcium phosphate and hydroxyapatite are quite common ones, as shown in this example here. So arthrodesis, so what and where? So generally we say that the low motion joints do well. So this will be something like the carpus is normally a good option for arthrodesis. Partial tarsal arthrodesis, you probably wouldn't even tell they've had it done. Pantarsal, you can just about see that they've had a pantarsal arthrodesis. Elbows don't tend to do very well because they're a high motion joint. Stifle, moderate, but actually surprisingly the shoulder works very well, and this is partly because of the way that the dog's scapula can move on its thorax. So shoulder arthrodesis, despite being high motion, can work well. So pancarpal or carpal arthrodesis can be divided into pancarpal arthrodesis or partial carpal arthrodesis. So pancarpal is fusion at all three joint levels. So we've got the antebrachial carpal joint, the intercarpal joint, and the carpometacarpal joint level. Whereas you could potentially do a partial carpal arthrodesis. And what this does is it avoids fusing the joint that does most of the motion in the carpus, the antebrachial carpal joint. However, when this has been done in clinical studies, there's been quite mixed outcomes. And this is because it's quite difficult to be sure that there's no damage here. So you can only really do this if you can be fairly convinced that this joint level is free of disease. And if it's not free of disease or damage, then you may get ongoing problems despite doing the partial carpal arthrodesis. So pancarpal by far and away tends to be the main way that we treat carpal problems. So in our preoperative preparation, it's very important to get radiographs. You need to take orthogonal view radiographs, so a dorsal palmar and a medial lateral views. I would always take stressed views. So to do a stressed view, it's good to have a neutral views comparison, so as shown here. And in the stressed view, if you use dog leads or ties with weights, you can then put a dorsal flexion, extension, onto the limb and actually stretch out this joint so you can see if there's a hyperextension and potentially what joint level it might be occurring at. Sometimes as well, partially subluxated bones or fractures only become apparent when you actually do this stressed view, so it's well worth doing this. I'd also template the contralateral limb because the carpus has got quite complicated anatomy and it really does help to have the opposite leg to compare to. And then your radiographs, obviously very important for templating. So you may have digital templates or you may have acetate templates such as these. It doesn't really matter what you have. The critical thing, if you've got acetate templates and you're using digital radiographs, is to use the scaling system. So normally these will have, like you just about make out here, a scale on them. You match that to the some sort of scale marker taken on your radiograph. So when you take your radiograph, you need a ball or a ruler on there so you can actually match the sizes. So for pancarpal arthrodesis, there's certain considerations with the templates. You need to have the radial carpal hole centered on the radial carpal bone. And you need to cover at least 50% of the metacarpal. And this has been shown to reduce the numbers of, or the frequency of metacarpal fracture if you actually make sure the plate is quite long and it reduces the lever arm effect. You then really want at least 3 screws in the metacarpal bone, at least 3 screws in the radius. And I wouldn't go above 40% of the bone diameter. And quite commonly, you may not have exactly the right implant, but that's fine. This is a salvage surgery. You don't need to rush. You can order what you need in and plan ahead. So here we are. Here's an example. This is using the veterinary instrumentation hybrid plate, which has got bigger holes proximally and smaller holes distally. So the central hole is designed to go over the radial carpal bone, which is shown here. And this is the standard size plate, but it comes up quite short. It's only not quite hitting 50% of the length of the third metacarpal. And generally, we plate along the third metacarpal up to the radius because this forms a nice straight line. So we may therefore be better off using the extra long version of this plate, which is shown here, which goes down to probably about 80% of the length of the third metacarpal bone. And I think this looks rather nice, so I'd go for that. So what equipment do you need? So you need a standard surgical set of equipment for doing most orthopedic or soft tissue surgeries, possibly with a couple of elevators, quite useful. For the bone graft, you're going to need some gelpies, a few drill bits, definitely no larger than 25% of the bone diameter. This is to open up just one cortex so you can actually get a Volkmann's keratin. These are sort of like spoons that you can pass through the hole, and then you can rotate them around and collect the cancellous bone. And it can be quite useful to put them in a pot, ideally in a blood-moistened swab, or you could use a syringe case and slide it open and put it in there, just in case you might knock them off the table or something like that. The actual arthrodesis themselves, you need a couple of pairs of gelpies, so these are self-retaining retractors, very useful. Homans are very useful, usually quite small, fine ones actually, quite helpful to get space in the joints. A high-speed burr, as I said, is best, but you can use a curet if you've got a few curets and they're quite sharp. And then you're going to need some plating sets. So you're going to need a pancarp orthodesis plates, and you're going to need a screw rack, and you're going to need all the standard drill, tap, depth gauge, and screwdriver. So I'd advise you to do a wide surgical clip. You definitely want the joint above. In terms of the carpus, you need to clip all the way down to the toes, and then you want the elbow joint exposed as well. So a big clip. This allows you to check alignment when you're actually doing the surgery. And if you're going to take a proximal humeral cancellous bone graft, if you're not going to use demineralized bone matrix off the shelf, then you need to clip all the way up there as well to have exposure. We would normally do a routine hippie scrub prep in the prep room, because we have a separate prep room before we move through to theatre. And this is normally 4% hippie scrub with water. We use non-sterile gloves and we clean until the swabs are visibly clean. And with pancarpal orthodesis, it is essential to clip all the fur off the toes, which is quite tricky and time consuming, but you really do have to do this. And then we actually make a hippie scrub bath in a non-sterile glove. We put the solution in here and massage the foot, and it's a really good way of getting the foot nice and clean. So positioning is really important, because if you get this in the wrong place, your whole surgery is going to be horrible. So before you pick up a blade, it's really important to make sure you've got everything in the right place. A hanging limb setup works well, so we use a drip stand with some ties, and then you probably, with a pancarpal orthodesis, is going to put a clip through the nail bed or through the webbing. I usually do them in dorsal recumbency with the limb extended cordially and then held by an assistant. And this gives you access to the carpus and the shoulder. But if you're on your own, then sternal works all right, and you could potentially put a Mayo table next to your operating table to support the leg. As I said, a clip through the claw or the webbing works quite well. Once in theatre, we do a second prep. We would put on sterile gloves, and we've got single applicators of basically a chlorhexidine and alcohol solution, so whatever your second prep system is. Previously, we used to do a second hippie scrub prep and then use an alcohol spray. It is helpful to have irrigation and suction with these procedures. And you also really do want to think about Holstead's principles, because they are quite prone to infection. They usually have limited soft tissues over the carpus, so you've got to be really careful. So gentle handling of the tissues, meticulous hemostasis. You want to preserve any blood vessels. You want to be really careful aseptic technique, because infection is really quite high in these procedures. You really do need to make sure there's no tension when you close the tissues, and we'll talk about that a bit later on. And you want to put the tissues back accurately. I don't use a tourniquet. I do have diathermy in surgery, which is helpful, but the trouble with a tourniquet is that you may not realize you've got bleeders until you actually take the tourniquet off at the end of the surgery, and it does limit the amount of time that you've got for operating, so I would generally not apply a tourniquet. So hopefully, if you're going to undertake any of these sorts of procedures, you've got this book. There is a newer edition that's blue. It's extremely good, and it has beautiful pictures which show you how to get to where you need to get to in orthopedic surgery, although quite often the actual procedure never looks quite like it does in the book, but it is really helpful. So I definitely recommend purchasing this book. So here we are. This is a cadaveric limb. We've got medial and lateral. These dots represent the bifurcation, the cephalic vein. This is something that I normally spend the whole surgery preserving, and then usually put a stitch through it when I'm closing. And here is sort of the outline of the carpal bone. So you're just getting an impression of where everything lies. So midline incision curving laterally, and usually from about the bifurcation of the cephalic. You can roll the skin around to avoid this, and you need to cover about 50% of the metacarpal region. And it's good, quite good to make it away from midline because you don't want the skin closure directly over the plate if you can avoid it. So here we go, make our skin incision with a scalpel blade like this and then place two pairs of galpies. Exposure really does help make the surgery a bit more straightforward. Next, we will then incise the subcutaneous tissue along the same same line, okay? And I would be very careful to pick the layers up individually, bluntly dissect them and then cut them, so you make sure you don't cut any of the tendons in the area. So now we're going to look at some anatomy. So this is what it looks like in the book. Looks pretty good in the book. And there is some similarities here. So we can see the common digital extensor, which is along here with all these branching lines to all the digits, because it's the common one. On the lateral side, you've got lateral. And then going on to the third metacarpal, we've got extensor carpi radialis. So next we need to make a deep antebrachial fascial incision. So you're going normally between extensor carpi radialis and common digital extensor. This little tissue band along here is adductor pollicis longus. It's generally better to leave it alone if you can avoid damaging it, but it's not overly essential. In us, it allows us to abduct our thumb. And you've got extensor carpi radialis inserting on the third metacarpal bones, and quite commonly this will be sacrificed. And I find it quite often helps to actually really mobilise these individual blocks of tendon so you can actually move them around. As I said, usually we transect it, but sometimes you can retract the extensor carpi radialis out of the way. Then get a periosteal elevator and you can do some undermining to identify where the joint spaces are. And then you're going to do an arthrotomy. I usually start at the antebrachial carpal joint level. This is the biggest joint level, so it's the easiest one to find. Getting the galpies into this gap and pushing out the way the tendons is very helpful. And flexion extension of the foot really helps you to identify where you're going and what you're identifying. Certainly for the smaller joints, A hypodermic needle such as this is really helpful because you can actually walk it off the bones and then find the intercarpal joint and the carpal metacarpal joint space. And then I'd use an 11 blade to open up these individual joint spaces and then walk my way down to the next space. Then finally, you're left with something like this. You've got three joint levels. You've got exposure to your third metacarpal, you've got exposure of your radius. And if you flex the joint, you can see right into the articular surface. Here's the radial carpal bone here, and here's the bottom of the radius, and you're going to be removing all the cartilage from those. And then we're going to make sure we've got a nice clear space for our implants. So at this point, you may be collecting your cancellous bone autograft, or you may be getting the DBM allograft off the shelf. This tends to be what we do because it's quicker and easier and seems to work fine. If you are taking cancellous bone, then typically you're taking it from the proximal humerus. So this is where the scapula is. This is where the proximal humerus is. You'll feel the greater tubercle here. Make a skin incision over that area. And then elevate down to the bone with the periosteal elevator. You can use a drill bit on a hand chuck. It doesn't have to be a power drill. And you are only going through one cortex, not both cortices. And then you can put your galpies in to make sure you've got good exposure. And you can get your Volkmann's correct into this area and circle it around to actually extract the cancellous bone. And then put that somewhere safe. So then we can go back to preparing the joint surfaces. So as I said, high speed burr is great, but you do need lots of irrigation and suction for this. Alternatively, as shown here, you could use a curette. It's really important to clear the cartilage off from all three joint levels and using a lever. So if we slide in a free elevator or Homan right at the back and then twist it, you actually lever open this joint space. And as you effectively get rid of the cartilage, you'll notice two things. You'll notice the colour will change to a more pinky colour. And if you actually use a metal instrument such as a Freer, you can actually run it over the surface and you will notice a distinct difference in how it feels. It will feel very sort of slippery where there's cartilage and you'll feel quite gritty and quite a lot of friction where there isn't. So it can be quite helpful for determining if this is cartilage in this sort of really caudal rim, which can be quite hard to find, or actually hard to see, but you may feel it more easily. When taking away the cartilage, it's important not to totally deform the shape of the bone. You don't want to take away too much subchondral bone, but you do need to get rid of all the cartilage. If you get rid of too much bone, it won't fit together very well. And then I would take a drill bit and actually open up the subchondral plate to allow some bleeding to occur. So then we need to think about plating. So a standard plating system. So we're going to drill, we're going to measure, we're going to tap, and then we're going to screw. Obviously, a lot of the time, people now have self-tapping screws. This step doesn't occur. So this is a fairly standard plate that you might use for pancarpal arthrodesis. It's a hybrid pancarpal arthrodesis plate. Bigger holes for the radius because it can take bigger screws, smaller holes for the third metacarpal bone because it's obviously smaller than the radius, and the radial carpal bone and hole in the middle. So generally place the radial carpal screw first, and then I would move to the metacarpal region because this is more difficult to get correctly aligned, and I'll place one or two screws in compression towards the osteotomy or towards the arthrodesis line here. And then I would then put a radial screw in, and again in compression, downwards now towards the radial carpal screw. And then the remaining screws can go in neutrally. Prior to this plate being available, people used to use a standard DCP, and you can actually drop down a size of screw. So if you had a 3.5 DCP, you can put 2.7 screws in the lower, in the holes over the metacarpal region, if you wished. So line up the plate, make sure the radial carpal screw hole is over the radial carpal bone, and make sure you've got 50% coverage of the third metacarpal. Now this plate is actually tapered underneath, so you get 5 degrees of extension. So generally speaking, we don't contour, despite the fact that normal extension is about 8 to 12 degrees in the dog. If it doesn't fit well, then you can burr flat the proximal aspect of the third metacarpal. It is important to try and get the plate to sit nice and flat. So you see there's a little bit of a rise here, so we can then burr that flat to make this plate sit down a bit better. Radial carpal screw goes in first, so we drill, we measure, and then we use self-tapping screws here, so we place that. And then you can flex the joint and see all the joint surfaces, and you can then extend it to then bring it back up to level with this with the plate. And at this point might be a good opportunity to pack in some deep bone graft because you can actually get this flexed open and pack that in. I then place a metacarpal screw in load. So this is using the gold end of the guide, and it points towards this line of the osteotomy, the carpometacarpal joint surface line. Place that screw. And make sure that the plate is actually aligned correctly along the bone, so it's not going to come off the metacarpal bone. That's your biggest issue really down here. So you need to make sure this is definitely on the bone. You could potentially place two small KYs either side of the bottom of this plate to keep it in alignment, or a couple of hypodermic needles. So we're going to check the alignment, looks good, and place some more screws. Then we will move up to the radius and place another screw in load, but this time in the opposite direction, so it's going to compress the antebrachial carpal joint level. Retighten both screws and then fill the remaining holes with screws in neutral, which is using the green end of the guide. So next we're going to flex and extend the elbow, check that the limb alignment is correct, you haven't induced a torsion or something. And then you may, it's quite a good idea to always flush at the end of orthopedic procedure, but you have to be very careful with the bone graft. And then once that's done, we then pack in the remaining bone graft wherever we can around the arthrodesis site. For closure, we would use a slowly absorbable monofilament. It really is important to use a monofilament absorbable because the infection risk is quite high with pancarpal arthrodesis. So something like PDS2 works well, usually in a simple continuous fashion. And if this is having problems getting this closed, it's worth undermining the skin a little bit. We really must close this without tension. Then we would close the subcutaneous tissue and place an intradermal suture and then skin sutures over the top. And as I said, tension will kill this procedure. If you get tension in the closure, you'll get wound breakdown, you get infection. So After arthrodesis, and this applies to all types of arthrodeses, we would do serial radiography. We would usually place a padded dressing for several days. We no longer perform external coaptation, and we expect follow-up to run at least up to 4 months. And you have to be aware that the complication rate is quite a lot higher than the standard fracture surgery. So immediate post-operative radiograph, so after surgery you should take radiograph straight away. This is to confirm the implant and limb alignment. And then at this stage, once that's been done, I would place a soft compression dressing for about 48 hours. And this is to minimise swelling, and potentially up to 4 days if there's a problem, but usually only about 48 hours. And then we discharge the patient once they're toe touching. I think this is quite a invasive procedure, so we would give opioids, and normally methadone during surgery, and probably for up to 24 hours, and then buprenorphine. They would be treated with a course of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for probably about 2 weeks. I'd say plus or minus tramadol. There's recent evidence that shows that tramadol has no beneficial effects at all for osteoarthritic pain. We're not sure about surgical pain, but the jury is out, I suppose. And antibiotics would normally be given perioperatively during surgery, and this is intravenous antibiotics dosed at 20 mg per kg, something like cefuroxime or potentiated amoxicillin. You could potentially carry this on up to 24 hours, and that would still be considered perioperative antibiotics. I wouldn't routinely give a course of antibiotics after surgery, and there is some evidence that in doing so you actually increase the risk of having a resistant infection developing if you do get an infection after surgery. At 10 to 14 days, we would remove the sutures and do a recheck. And then I really go to the 8 week side of this, would be for the first follow up. And we're looking for radiographic signs of healing, that there's some new bone formation within the gap, that the implants look okay. And normally we're seeing an improvement in the dog's lameness, and it's worth palpating the limb for any discomfort. And then probably we'll be back again in another 8 weeks, so it's about 16 weeks. And usually by this stage, we've got some fairly good radiographic union, and there isn't that much ongoing healing beyond this. So generally speaking, that will be the last time, but occasionally we may do one more recheck if there's an issue. So this study looked at the healing of pancarpal arthrodesis in the dog, and basically showed that by week 12, most of the healing has occurred, but the radial carpal joint, which is level, which is the solid line here, so this joint here is the one that takes the longest to heal, and actually that hasn't completely healed until you get to about 32 weeks. But generally speaking, by the time you got to 3 months, you've got a pretty good idea where things are going. So our check at 8 weeks is fairly indicative, and then 16 weeks is usually sufficient, but occasionally, say, we would add another recheck later on. So normally we'd suggest lead walks only, and otherwise rest. 5 minutes three times a day for the first 2 weeks, moving to 10 minutes, then 15, then 20. I would stick at 20 until we see a union. I won't go any further. Room rest or cage rest is normally appropriate, and certainly no running, jumping or climbing or free garden access, at least until 3 months. So it's not easy for the owners with these cases. So there's a very high reported complication rate of up to 50% and a revision surgery rate of up to 25% in the published literature. And this is normally due to screw loosening, metacarpal fracture, failure of bony fusion, implant breakage or infection. So optimal surgical technique and meticulous aftercare are really important because these are vulnerable surgeries. But, you know, often when you do this, you do actually really make a really positive impact because the prognosis for return to function is normally good as long as it goes well, and that's even for working dogs. So what other modifications are there? So rather than using this standard hybrid plate, some years ago there was a castless plate brought out. Now this plate was brought out because we used to always place a cast with pancarpal arthrodesis, and people wanted to avoid this. So this plate actually inserts on two metacarpals. But as you can see here, there's a little fracture in this metacarpal bone, and it's quite easy to actually fracture the bones when you place this plate. So I generally don't use this one. There was a group in Spain that developed a step plate. This is because you notice that quite often you get a bit of a gap, or you may even actually pull this bone slightly out of alignment. So they developed a plate that actually sit in this gap, but this plate had lots of failures and lots of problems, so this never came to the market. Other options are to use standard plates, as I discussed, and this tends to be more what happens when we do cats, or to use double plating. I've not had the need to use double plating, but some centres do this. Palmar plating was reported many, many years ago, and this is because it's biomechanically on the tension side, so this is a good side to put the plate on, but the surgical approach is actually horrible. Medial plating is also biomechanically quite strong, but again, more difficult than placing the plate on the dorsal aspect, so we tend to do dorsal plating. Sometimes we may put cross K-wires. This increases the strength of failure of the arthrodesis, but usually it's unnecessary, and quite often it makes the surgery a little bit more difficult. So what's the evidence for what we do? So we used to do a lot of external coaptation. We're going to talk about the evidence of castus implants and the evidence for pan versus partial tarsal arthrodesis now. So postoperative coaptation, which actually placing a cast after surgery, was recommended because the easiest place to put the plate is on the dorsal surface here. And because dogs all stand with a bit of degree of extension, usually up to about 10 to 12 degrees, this actually means that this surface is a compression surface and this is a tension surface. So plates are actually quite vulnerable if you put them on their compression surface. They're actually more likely to fail than if they're on the tension surface. So it's suggested that to protect the plate, we would put a postoperative cast on. And this was orthopedic dogma for many years. And this was recommended for up to 6 to 8 weeks, but there was actually no evidence to support this. This was just sort of what was thought at the time to be a sensible precaution. However, we know that casting carries quite significant risks. This was a dog that had a cast placed after Achilles tendon repair, and the dog went lame and the cast started to smell, but the owner didn't get in touch for quite some time. When we actually saw them, actually there's total slough of the metatarsal pad here. So this is really sort of awful injury that this dog developed secondary to the cast. So because of this, we did a study and we actually looked at what was going on with these. And we looked at all orthopedic procedures that had a cast placed. And we had 60 animals. And what we showed was that in the 60 animals, around 60% of them will develop some sort of soft tissue injury. Although on the majority of them, so 60% of those injuries will be mild. They're normally rubs, erythema, a bit of hair loss. 20% will be moderate, so that would be sort of superficial breaks in the skin, and 20% would be severe as described. So although these are relatively not that common, but they can happen and they can be quite severe. We showed that sight hounds were significantly more likely to develop them, so I definitely wouldn't put a cast on a sight hound. And that these injuries could occur at any time during the period of time that they have external coaptation in place. The other thing we identified was that it's actually normally the vet that identifies these problems. So we recommended that it was important to take the cast off and check the soft tissues underneath at least weekly by the vet. So around the same sort of time, as I said, OrthoMed marketed the castus plate, which sounds like a great idea. They designed this plate so you don't need to put a cast on. And their reasoning was that, having the plate shape design and the fact it screwed into two metacarpals would mean that it wouldn't cause a problem. And there were some studies that showed you had quite good outcomes without using a cast, although there were higher intraoperative metacarpal fractures from this procedure. So we were interested in what was going on here. So we actually compared the standard plate to the castus plate mechanically. And we did this test here. We did cyclic fatigue and we also did single cycle failure. So we actually bent the plates and saw how strong they were. And basically, there was no difference in their strength, but the veterinary instrumentation plate, the standard plate, the non-castus plate was actually slightly stiffer. So we couldn't really, based on that, recommend that the castus plate was any better than the standard plate. This then prompted us to look at what were people doing that were doing lots of pancarpal alpha DCs. So we had 219 dogs from several referral centres, and what we found was that many people were not casting, and they were using the standard hybrid plate, and they were not having any problems. And actually, when casts were placed, it didn't reduce any sort of failures, but did lead to an increase in soft tissue complications. And the biggest issue with pancarpal alpha DCs was surgical site infection. And as I said, carpal hyperextension was the most common cause of injury. So from all of that, we can say that there probably isn't really a good reason to place a cast, and if you are, you're probably making a high likelihood chance that you'll get some sort of complication to deal with, and you can use a standard plate successfully without having any plate failures or problems, even without a cast. So generally, we would avoid using a cast now. So the options for pan versus partial carpal arthrodesis. So we know that arthrodesis is good for low motion joints, and we know that we can do a pancarpal or a partial carpal arthrodesis. And a pancarpal arthrodesis is definitely indicated if you've got damage at the antebrachial carpal joint level, or if multiple joint levels are affected. And the partial carpal only, well, leaves the antebrachial carpal joint level, which is the one that does most of the movement in the carpus, unaffected. When you actually look at the spread of injuries, there was a study from some years ago that showed about a third of the injuries are actually at the antebrachial carpal joint. A further sort of fifth are at the intercarpal joint level, and nearly 50% at the carpal metacarpal joint level. So this would imply that there's a good reason to do partial carpal arthrodesis in many, many dogs, because nearly three quarters of them won't have any damage to the antebrachial carpal level. However, it's really difficult to actually confirm this and be sure that you've got this right. And there was quite old study now, 1991, where they reviewed 50 dogs which had either partial or pancarpal arthrodesis. And actually, the ones that had pancarpal arthrodesis, 75% of them returned to what was considered more or less fully functional, whereas the ones that had partial carpal arthrodesis, only 50%. And this was attributed to the fact that partial carpal arthrodesis was probably being performed in some animals where there was actually damage to the antebrachial carpal joint level, which wasn't stabilized because he had a partial carpal arthrodesis. More recently, however, there's been a study where they used force plates. They actually measured how the dogs are using their legs. And what they showed is there's no significant difference between pancarpal and partial carpal arthrodesis, apart from partial carpal arthrodesis dogs had better propulsion. This is probably because they can use that joint level as sort of a bit of a spring, so it'll flex as they put their weight down, and they can then spring it up to actually get a better propulsion. So really, it boils down to how sure can we be that the antebrachial carpal joint level isn't damaged, and it is difficult. CT may potentially be a better way to evaluate that, but CT isn't available for most people. So partial carpal arthrodesis is good if you can accurately select the cases, which most of the time we don't feel that we can, so we still generally stick to a pancarpal arthrodesis. But if you had a working dog, it might be one to consider, and it might be worth taking that extra time and effort and maybe doing a CT to try and really fully evaluate the antebrachial carpal joint level. So in summary, a pancarpal arthrodesis is an effective technique for the right patient. It's certainly significantly more challenging than a simple fracture repair, and you really do have to be ready for the fact that there's a higher risk of infection. Now, some of that will be related to the amount of time it takes, some of it will be related to the severity of the procedure. It's a salvage surgery, and it's also probably related to the lack of soft tissues in the area. So, meticulous surgical technique, trying to keep the surgery time as short as possible, but without rushing, is really important. But you will have to counsel owners that there are risks associated with this procedure, and they're much higher than in a standard fracture repair surgery. However, in the right patients, you can have really good outcomes, and it can really help them, and it can get rid of pain and dysfunction and work very effectively. Okay, so now we can move to some questions. So I've got a couple of questions in here. So let's have a look. Do I burr the joint cartilage in between the individual carpal bones, i.e., in between the radial and ulnar carpal bones, and between two and three, and three and four? So no. So the surfaces that you're burring are the ones that are in alignment with each other. You don't really need to worry about going in between the actual sides of the bones themselves. So you have plenty to do just taking the cartilage off from the weight-bearing surfaces, I guess, is what I'm really saying. So the surface of the radius that actually articulates with the radial carpal bone, and then the surfaces below are the ones that you need to really focus on. So you don't need to try and get the bur in between these gaps. The other question is, do I use paracetamol and how long for? So paracetamol is an interesting one. So I generally would only use it in dogs where I have got a contraindication problem for using a non-steroidal, and we really don't have any good evidence that paracetamol is very effective as an analgesic for these types of procedures, although they would be quite commonly used in people. So if I were to use paracetamol, I would be using the there's obviously there's the Pardale, which is paracetamol with codeine, and that's only licensed for 5 days. Or you could use standard paracetamol prescribed under the Cascade at 10 mg/kg twice a day, and you can use that for longer periods if you wish. Generally speaking, I would only be providing about 2 weeks of analgesia. Most of the time, by that point, the dogs are doing really well and don't need anything further. So, what else we got? So, do I drill or fenestrate into the radial surface of the radial carpal bone also? I would take it a little bit of judgment as to how it was when it burred. It tends to be the underside of the radius, the articular surface of the radius, that the subchondral plate tends to be quite thick. So I always drill holes into that. The radial carpal bone, and it depends on the size of the dog, can start to get quite small. What you can do if you want to sort of open up a bit more is you can put a very small burr end on the burr and just make some small indentation holes, or put a K wire on a chuck to sort of almost micro pick the surface. But normally that bone, once you start burring it, you normally get to quite pink bone, so you normally feel fairly confident. So it's generally the radial side that I would do that for. Also got a question about Cowpole for small patients. No, I've never used Cowpole for small patients. My worry about this, I did discuss this with someone about a year ago. My real worry about this is whether or not it could lead to owners using some of the sugar-free preparations, because dogs can actually have significant toxic problems with some of the sweeteners that are used as an alternative to sugar. And there's a lot of other ingredients in Cowpole, which I don't know as to whether or not they would cause any problematic effects in a dog. So I don't know of anyone or any evidence of using Cowpole in dogs, but it's something that's I would cons it's something worth considering, but I really couldn't advise doing that at this stage. And then we've also got a question: if the joint space is larger than desired after plate application, is pancarpal arthrodesis more likely to fail? Yeah, so we don't really know that. It's quite logical that if you leave a great big space, then you haven't got load sharing between the plate and the bone. What you quite commonly find is that the joint space is actually quite open on the far side and quite closed on the near side to the plate. So that doesn't is not an uncommon problem. Obviously, if the space was huge, I would be more worried about it. And that's why it can be quite good to try and pack in some bone graft right at the back of the joint surface to try and help that. So yeah, it's certainly a consideration, but I haven't seen any fail for that reason, and I actually haven't in the literature. Plate failure is extremely rare, which is probably going to be the issue here, such that the plate's being cycled and it actually breaks. And that only happened. There was a study, quite an old study. I think it had 50 dogs, and one plate failed, and that was a failure of arthrodesis union, not so much the gap size itself. But I think it's worth trying to avoid a big gap, because also a big gap's going to take longer to heal. Okay, so I don't think we've got any more questions. So by all means, if you have any further questions, then get in touch. But otherwise, I hope this has been a useful lunchtime webinar, and I wish you all the best with your future pancarpal arthrodesis endeavours. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Richard for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.